Good morning. We're delighted to have with us this morning several classes. Appleton North High School, would those students please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. Iowa Grant High School, would those students stand? Thank you all for coming. You may be seated. And Nuglaris High School. It's good seeing you all. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program, cleverly entitled Court with Class. We invite, along with the State Bar, we invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the class agrees to come, the class is given materials relating to the oral argument and may engage in activities relating to the case. And at noon, or after the second argument, I should say, the students are invited to come back into the courtroom. And they will talk with a justice of this court, not about the substantive cases, but about the procedures the court uses to decide which cases to take and how we decide the case. Everyone is welcome to these discussions. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left, Justice Robinson. Justice Robinson will be the assigned justice today to talk with the class. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call the first case today, 06AP2910, Kenneth Behrendt. Behrendt, I should say, versus Gulf Underwriters Insurance Company. Representing the plaintiff, Kenneth Behrendt, is Mark S. Young. And you may take the podium.
May it please the court. My partner, Rhonda Lanford, and I feel that it's an honor to be able to appear before you on behalf of Ken Behrendt, who was brain injured on June 15, 2004, when a metal tank under pressure exploded and struck him in the head. On August 4, 2006, the Circuit Court for Marinette County dismissed Ken's claims against Sylvan Industries. This case raises two very, very important issues for the court, or subjects. First is the issue of duty and the application of public policy considerations under Wisconsin's negligence law. And secondly, an issue of vicarious liability. When is an employer responsible for its employees? We believe that allowing the decisions of the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court to stand would set a dangerous precedent and add further confusion into our negligence law, which could lead to more motions to dismiss on public policy grounds, as we see them happening more often and more often out in the trial courts. We ask that you reverse the grant of summary judgment and remand to the Circuit Court for trial on issues of negligence and vicarious liability.
Mr. Young, let me ask you, based on what you just said, are you concerned with the fact that the Court of Appeals basically made a decision here using the idea of duty and foreseeability?
Yes, Your Honor. We think that's directly contrary to what was stated in Pfeiffer and Wisconsin's approach to negligence law with regard to the minority view in Palsgraf.
I'm sure you recognize that over the course of several years, on occasion, this court has looked at whether or not there was a duty. but that that's not the normal approach that we take. The normal approach we take is on, if we're going to say you can't continue, it's on a public policy determination. Why should that make a difference to us? Why is that important?
Wisconsin's law has long stood for the proposition that the where there is negligence, cutting off liability on the grounds of remoteness, etc., is more a public policy consideration than an initial view of duty. And this has been our law forever, and this case itself shows one of the problems when we see the Court of Appeals decision in paragraph 13 listing a long sequence of seven steps to show that this is somehow disconnected. That's exactly the majority opinion in Palsgraf, which we've rejected. And so our court has long recognized that the cutting off of liability for public policy grounds should await a full resolution of the facts and then be applied so that we can judge the whole case.
Do you think that when you look at the paragraph you just mentioned, paragraph 13, that that also could be read in tying into the idea of remoteness on a public policy basis?
Well, I think that the court itself mentioned that.
And
I disagree with that conclusion, of course.
And yet, though, they then get back to this idea of foreseeability and of duty, or they seem to do that, do they not?
Well, I think the remoteness does have implications of foreseeability, as do several of the other factors in the public policy considerations. So foreseeability is still part of our law, and we're not talking about a situation where Mr. Barrett gets hit in the head and somebody sued one of the other people at the oil change place that had nothing to do with it.
Well, do you think your chances of winning in this case are better if we look at this in terms of a public policy determination, or should we be looking at it in terms of duty, or should we be looking at it in terms of causation? Which gives you the best chance of winning?
Well, I think we have to address all of those issues in any case, and I believe that if the proper approach is applied, then Mr. Barron should prevail here. We obviously have differences of opinion about how the public policy factors would apply. I'm sure Sylvan says this is remote. We disagree with that. And we disagree with the courts using this type of analysis in paragraph 13, sort of a Rube Goldberg sequence of events. That's not how Wisconsin law works. So we, and over the past, 10, 15 years, we've seen more and more trial courts, I believe, and it's reflected in decisions, throwing cases out on public policy. The Court of Appeals and this court has had to rectify that in several situations and allow cases to go to trial. Cases that have facts like these ought to be heard by juries.
Mr. Young,
yes.
How, if at all, does it impact your argument, and I'd ask opposing counsel to address this too, that the tank was originally made to collect oil, and then it was later modified, not by the person who made it to collect oil, but modified by the employer, I believe, to become a pressurized tank. How does that impact your analysis, and how does that work for your purposes?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's an important point that's raised in the materials, and it's a disputed issue of fact. Mr. Leshinsky, who owns the oil place, said all along, said it in his deposition, said it in an affidavit, that he asked for a tank that could be pressurized. He always intended it to be pressurized. Of course it's going to collect oil. And Mr. Harding's work on the tank was necessary to hook it up to a pressurized system. We also have, and it's undisputed, submitted the testimony through affidavit of Alan Sells, a pressure vessel expert, who said that nothing Mr. Harding did altered the characteristics of the tank insofar as its ability to withstand pressure. So, for example, we don't have Mr. Harding doing something that weakened welds or did anything like that. All he was doing was attaching the necessary fittings so it could be hooked up to the pressurized system, which was what the intention was all along.
Didn't he fill holes that were in the tank? I thought it was not suitable to be used as a pressurized tank when it left the manufacturer's plant.
Without being hooked up, of course, it's not usable in that fashion. And
well, my question was, didn't it have holes in it? I mean, weren't there holes in it, and holes had to be plugged, or it couldn't
In order to collect oil anyway, and to for its use. So the, and, you know, Mr. Leshinsky says that he told Mr. Fisher, I want a tank that can withstand the pressure.
But what they made wasn't a tank that would withstand pressure if it had holes in it, correct?
Well, I disagree with that in terms of how that all applies in the facts. You start with the shell and you attach it. The shell itself isn't a tank, and it's got to be put together. There were some holes that needed to be closed and fittings to put on other holes to hook it up. But the tank was always intended to be used under pressure, and there is no dispute it was not sufficient for that.
Counsel, you earlier indicated that foreseeability is still part of our law. What part or role does foreseeability play?
Well, Your Honor, the foreseeability is, in my opinion, particularly part of the negligence analysis. We do read in the decisions, for example, in Alvarado, this court explained as to duty that in Wisconsin, a duty to use ordinary care is established whenever it is foreseeable that a person's act or failure to act might cause harm to some other person. So foreseeability is mentioned in the duty part of the analysis. And then when we get to the negligence, a person is not using ordinary care and is negligent if that person, without intending to do harm, or fails to do something, does something or fails to do something that a reasonable person would recognize meaning foreseeability, as creating an unreasonable risk of injury or damage to a person or property. So we do have that in our analysis. However, Wisconsin has stood for the proposition that one always owes a duty of care to the world at large. We've all heard that said over and over again. It's like a mantra. But I don't think that means that I owe a duty to somebody in a gas station somewhere else at this moment while I'm before you, but that...
Well, I don't know about that. I think you do owe a duty to everyone. It's just that whatever you do here is not going to be negligent as to any gas station owner.
Correct.
I mean, I can't foresee that you would do anything.
Well, and that's the Wisconsin analysis. We all owe a duty to refrain from negligence in whatever we're doing. And so what the Court of Appeals did here is say there is no duty because this wasn't foreseeable. That's not the Palsgraf minority. We all know that, I think. And we now have to proceed with, is there negligence? And let me just come back to duty for a second. You know, here's Sylvan has a program. It's a government-instituted program that allows its employees, as a benefit to the employees and which benefits its company, to take the means and the materials and the facilities to produce, in this case, a dangerous instrumentality and trap loose out in the public.
How does that program really benefit the employer?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How does that it was referred to as the government program, although
right.
In the colloquialism of the workplace, that's what it was called, but it had nothing to do with the government. You just said in your statement that that was a benefit to the employer, that the employees could do this. How did that benefit the employer?
Well, Mr. Saar testified that it benefited Sylvan by providing this perk to the employees, and it was a morale booster. No different than, I would say, a law firm that has a kitchen that allows its employees to use a microwave and provide that kind of a perk. And so Sylvan had a duty to operate that program with about negligence. In fact, Sylvan takes the position in this case, we prohibited people making
pressurized tanks.
Well, that in and of itself acknowledges that it is dangerous to let people create vessels to be used under pressure. And they have a duty, in my opinion, to take steps to prevent that, which may, in some situations, include not allowing the program at all.
Sir, yes. Could I go back to the question of duty? In the old days when I was in law school, we talked about duty, breach, causation, and damages. If you were suing me in tort for negligence, would I ever be able to assert that I didn't have a duty?
Well, of course, I think that's one of the things this court's going to confront in this case.
I thought you said something here when you were talking at the podium. Well, I don't have a duty to a gas station in some remote place. I understand our concept of duty is going to be extremely broad. But is there ever a time that, say, as a defendant, I could assert I didn't have a duty here?
I can't think of one.
Well, what about somebody who sees somebody in danger? You don't generally have an obligation to go rescue them.
So the relationship between the person and the situation, and I've heard it explained this way, that you have to have a relationship with society or the other person. For example, as a driver, that's our relationship, and we therefore have a duty to act reasonably in doing that. I think Chief Justice has perhaps pointed out a situation where a citizen doesn't have a responsibility to affirmatively act, and that's not exactly the same thing as being negligent or not negligent.
And there'll be cases, although omission versus commission also has its own set of problems, but there'll be cases where in omission the court will go off on a different kind of analysis for duty than it does when there is commission. And so that would be one of failing to rescue. And there may be others on failing to tell when you know something. And the question there, do you have a special relationship? So there are some very special circumstances where the court looks at duty to care differently than it does on action of saying duty of care to the entire world.
We see here that Sylvan had this policy that allowed all this, but they claim today, not surprisingly, you can't make pressure vessels. We dispute. That's an issue of fact in this case because of the proof that has been put forward here that...
I want to go back to Justice Prosser's question of duty, breach, causal connection, and actual loss. And I'm looking at that Appendix 5 of your brief on the Court of Appeals decision. And it says to maintain a claim for negligence. And I think that means to assert liability on the defendant. There must be a duty of care, a breach of that duty. And it seems to me that in lawyer language, a breach of a duty is negligence.
Yes, I agree.
And then item 3 is a causal connection between the conduct, which is negligent conduct, and the injury. And 4, actual loss or damage. So the word negligence really means a breach of a duty of due care. And the 4 items there means there's liability. You're missing one of those items, there's no liability. Doesn't mean there's no negligence.
I agree with that. If all four elements are not there, and if we come back to Justice Prosser's question of when is there ever a situation where there's not a duty, and there are certain situations, I would imagine, but in an ordinary negligence context, like acts of commission, a person has a duty to act with reasonable care in performing those acts. And here, this company made available to its employees the means, facilities, equipment, everything, to be able to produce something that turned out to be dangerous. They knew it was could be dangerous. They even said they knew that so much they didn't want people to do this. And so we've got facts wrapping around each other and make this a perfect case for, or the proper places for a jury to resolve those.
If you were going to write an opinion in this case, how would you clean up? I'm assuming that it has to be cleaned up. How would you clarify all of our prior cases that talk about duty? Paul's graph majority, Paul's graph minority.
Well, I think the court has done that several times recently. In Alvarado, the court did that and laid things out the way it should have been in terms of the steps. And I would say that I would reaffirm, as it was said, that...
Which case do you think is just terrific to clarify so that we would just adopt that language and be
well,
done
I
with this?
My,
hey, you know, when was Paul's graph? In the 20s?
It's in the 20s.
Well,
and fight
it's now almost 100 years. Not quite. 90 years.
Just this weekend... Ms. Lanford and I were reading Pfeiffer. And Pfeiffer
oh, you must have had a good time.
'50s, and it reads like a treatise on Wisconsin negligence law. And the same concepts apply there. And in, it's pointed out in that case that where we have our approach of the minority of Pal's graph, and people have a duty to everyone in the world, now you apply negligence, and then you get to the policy considerations, and it talks about, it's in an extreme case where it shocks the conscience of society that there would be liability.
Counselor, haven't we really nuanced Pell's graph in a number of cases since it first came down? For example, if you look at Hoyta, we nuanced it based on a contractual statement that the person who was sued would not be responsible for collecting lien waivers in regard to the construction of a building. Yet there was a suit against the bank because they were, quote, negligent in not collecting lien waivers. And I think in that case, we didn't disavow Pell's graph, the minority opinion, at all. But what we said is, yes, there is a duty of due care to everyone, but the scope of that duty varies depending on the circumstances of the case. And this certainly isn't a contractual case, as Poyta was, and that was the major circumstance that was relied on. But I don't think the duty is so, by the decisions of this court, so without any nuances that you can just go back and look at Paul's graph and say the case is over, there's absolutely a duty here. And I understand from your brief you don't see a nuance in the scope of the duty that you're setting out here, but I disagree that our case law is quite so black and white as you argue.
Well, there's always going to be exceptions. Each case is, like I like to talk about them, they're like snowflakes. Everyone is a little bit different, and it's very difficult, especially when we're dealing with the constellation of facts that add up to negligence. It'd be nice if it went on just a nice, beautiful, linear line, but that's not how life works. And so we have to go back to the basic principles, and you're right, Your Honor, that I do believe there is not a nuance in this situation. The company itself acknowledged its own duty.
But you do, under our case law, have to look at the circumstances surrounding the claim duty, and that's all I wanted to point out to you. I don't think it's just, oh, there's a duty to everyone, that's the end of the discussion.
Agreed.
There are fiduciary duties. That's different than ordinary, the kind of case that you're advocating here based on a special relationship, correct?
Right. And, if, you know, take the Rockwight case with Mrs. Tynan sitting at the campfire. This court held she had a duty.
Well, take the Hattelburg case of Justice Prosser, where he kind of alluded to special relationships and fiduciary duties.
I want to just touch on negligence, the breach. There is no dispute in the record. Sylvan has not raised anything that disputes the opinion of our expert submitted that pointed out that this was a failure to exercise reasonable care, that this was an accident waiting to happen. It was egregiously short-sighted and allowed a circumvention of Sylvan's own system for making sure safe vessels got out, only safe vessels got out. And I better turn, my light just got me running short, and
I'll try to formulate a question. Sylvan is a manufacturer. The use of its space and its facilities for these government jobs is viewed as a perk. I think that's what you said to the employees.
Yes.
You use the example of a law firm that allows its employees to have a microwave or a refrigerator or something like that. A lot of companies have sports teams. Isn't it foreseeable that some employee could get ill from something that was kept in a refrigerator maybe too long? Isn't that foreseeable? Isn't it foreseeable that if a company sponsors a sports team, someone could get injured playing softball or touch football or anything like that? And where is, are there any lines drawn here?
I wish there were. I think things are more gray than that, and each case depends on the facts. We, in this case, Mr. Laffey, I assume, is going to say, well, is Sylvan going to be responsible if one of its fire pits does something wrong that these people make under the government projects? I think in our situation, we're talking about a dangerous instrumentality, this specific case. And, for example, a company that has chemicals, should that company be allowed to just let their employees, with a wink and a nod for a government job, use those chemicals? That case could be a different situation where the court could say, no, they have to act reasonably. And an expert like Mr. Sills here would say that that's negligence. And, you know, we have the, there's the cases, talking about public policy with the guns. There's one with the guest at the house comes and there's a loaded gun on the bed. And the guest picks up the loaded gun, bobbles it, it goes off. And, yeah. I think that's Stewart versus Wolf. And the court there said this should go to trial. This can fly under our Wisconsin law because it's a dangerous object. Same thing happened in Olson versus Ratzel, where this person sold a gun to a minor, and then the minor went and shot somebody. The seller was trying to say, why should I be responsible? You should cut this off on public policy grounds. The court said, no, that should go to trial. May I just touch on vicarious liability?
Are you going to have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel?
Okay, so should I save that for then?
Yes, please.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Your Honor.
Laffey? So for our defendants, Underwriter Insurance Company and Sylvan Industries.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is John Laffey, and with my partner, Michael Rosenberg, we are here today to represent the interests of the defendants in this case, Phelp Underwriters and Sylvan. I would like to start off with vicarious liability, if I may. There are two prongs to this appeal. One of them regards the duty analysis, which we spent much time talking about. The other part regards a claim that Sylvan was in some way responsible for Mr. Fisher's actions in this case. And it's important to understand what the claim is not. The claim is not that vicarious liability in this case applies to anything that Mr. Summers did. And the claim that Mr. Barron is putting forth is that somehow Mr. Fisher's agreement to provide a tank to his son-in-law, which is undisputed in this record that the son-in-law knew that Mr. Fisher could have things made at work that were personal to Mr. Fisher. Mr. Fisher, it is undisputed, knew that this tank that was requested was a personal, or in the colloquialism of the case, a government job. Mr. Fisher asked Mr. Summers, who was both an employee on a second shift at Sylvan and a family friend of Mr. Fisher, if he would assist Mr. Fisher in fabricating this tank as a personal job. There is no confusion in this case from any witness or any involved person that the tank was created outside of the ordinary business of Sylvan. Mr. Linchensky admitted in deposition that he had no relationship with Sylvan whatsoever as regards this tank. He did not seek a tank from Sylvan, although he could have. He did not purchase a tank from Sylvan, although he could have. He asked his father to do him a favor and get him a tank as a personal job at Sylvan. And that's what happened. The law in the state on scope of employment and vicarious liability, master-servant law, for eons, talks about the analysis being to look at the intention and the actions of the servant. In this case, because there's no issue of the conduct of Mr. Summers, Mr. Barron admits that Mr. Summers is not negligent. Therefore, you can't have vicarious liability for a non-negligent act. The alleged negligence has to do with Mr. Fisher. And Mr. Fisher's behavior in this case manifests no intent to benefit the employer whatsoever.
Mr. Laffey, let me interrupt you for a minute just so we're clear on the record. Mr. Summers' role in all this was what? Was he the welder?
Yes, Your Honor. He was a welder working second shift.
And you've made the point in your briefs, or your brief, I should say, that he was not sued directly, Summers. Why is that significant?
Well, I don't know if I made that point directly that he wasn't sued. What's significant is that Mr. Barron admits that Mr. Summers did nothing negligent. Mr. Summers made and fabricated what was provided to him, and there's no dispute in this case that what resulted from Mr. Summers' efforts was the creation of a tank that was not to be subjected to pressure.
Well, isn't there, maybe I misread what I thought I read here, but isn't there some allegation that the expert for the plaintiff has said that the welds here were inappropriate, that they weren't done sufficiently to allow this to be a safe tank?
The issue, as you're referencing, Your Honor, is not that the welds were insufficient for a non-pressurized tank.
Right.
The issue is, if this tank was made by Mr. Summers, with Mr. Summers intending to create a pressure-bearing tank, then the fabrication of that tank would be inadequate. There is no dispute in this record that that is a correct statement. Sylvan is not saying that the tank that was produced by Mr. Summers at Mr. Fisher's request was supposed to be a pressure-bearing tank. It was not.
So the welds are okay if it's a non-pressurized tank, but there might be a question if it was intended to be a pressurized tank.
That would be the issue relative to the failure of the tank once pressure was applied. But if this was used as fabricated as a non-pressurized tank, there's no criticism in this record of the construction of the tank for a non-pressurized purpose. So the question becomes whether Mr. Fisher and his actions as they relate to Mr. Linchensky somehow fall under Sylvan's responsibility as the master to Mr. Fisher. And I submit to you on the record before this court that there's nothing to support responsibility by Sylvan for what Mr. Fisher apparently agreed to, based on the record, to provide Mr. Linchensky. What is clear is that if Mr. Linchensky said, Mr. Fisher, I need a pressurized tank, from that point forward, as it worked through Sylvan on the government jobs program with Mr. Summers, no steps were taken to provide that.
Well, counsel, what would your response be to your opposing counsel's assertion that Sylvan did in fact benefit by this government jobs program in the form of increased employee morale?
I would say that that is an invalid consideration for master-servant law, Your Honor. I would say that whether or not you determine the employer has some amorphous benefit because the employees are happier or more secure or feel better, the morale is higher, that's not the analysis. The analysis is whether or not the conduct of the employee is actuated by the intention to benefit the interests of the employer. And clearly, there's no connection between producing this tank as a favor to Mr. Fisher, which was a favor to Mr. Linchensky, provides any benefit whatsoever or furthers the business purpose of Sylvan Industries. I think the scope of employment issue is one that needs to be stricken down, and the Court of Appeals is to be affirmed on that issue because there's nothing here that supplies a basis for thinking that Mr. Fisher's actions in any way, shape, or form benefited the master in this case.
Counsel, if Mr. Fisher was asked to build a pressurized tank, how does that affect your vicarious liability position?
Well, we're taking, first of all, Your Honor, we're taking the facts as we have to infer them on the record. That is, Mr. Linchensky has testified that he asked for a pressurized tank. So we must assume that to be true for this purposes. And taking that as true, my answer is it does not affect in terms of enhancing the scope of employment argument. I think it actually cuts against it, because Mr. Fisher, being a longtime supervisory employee of Sylvan, clearly knew that making a product in direct competition to what the employer makes, i.e. a pressurized tank, would be a violation of the business interest of Sylvan, which would be clearly contrary to basic master-servant law. You would be competing against your employer. And insofar as it relates to the government jobs policy, as Mr. Young noted many times, the company was acceptable with making personal items as long as they weren't pressure tanks like the company made. So I think it all would work against, Your Honor, finding scope of employment to be applicable here.
Thank you.
What do they call it? Government jobs?
I can tell you it's probably not in the record, but I've never gotten an answer, and I don't think Mr. Young got an answer from a witness. It's just one of those things. They call them government jobs, and maybe it doesn't have a nice ring to what people think the government does. I don't know, but it's an odd anachronism, but they call them government jobs. So if we find out, we'll supplement the briefing.
I think we'd appreciate that.
Turning it to the discussion of, let me turn to material issues of fact first. Mr. Young, as an overarching theme of his argument, has said really the appropriate forum for resolution of this case at this stage is to send it back to the trial court and have a trial, have a jury decide this. And I would present to the court that, in fact, there's nothing left to be gained by just submitting it to the jury. The critical facts are here before this court. As the trial court noted in its decision and the Court of Appeals noted, there's really nothing further to be discovered. It's just choosing a decision maker which is what Mr. Barron is asking this court to do, and choose a decision maker to make a legal ruling based upon a settled set of facts. That's this court's job.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. What approach do you think this court should take? Should we take the approach, if we were to find in your favor, of the Court of Appeals and say, gee, there really is no duty here? Or do you think we should be looking at this in terms of public policy and saying what occurred here is too remote and therefore there should not be recovery? Or should we be looking at this in terms of, was there a breach of a duty, the broad Hallsgraf minority duty approach? What's your preference here?
I think you can go either of two ways. I think you can take a look at this case on duty grounds. I understand quite clearly the very broad concept of duty in Wisconsin. There are very few quotes from cases that I remember from reading in law school, and the only one I can bring to mind is from the Paulsgraf majority opinion. The risk reasonably to be foreseen defines the duty to be owed. I understand that's not the law in Wisconsin. However, in every formulation of duty that I've read in this court's opinions, foreseeability is front and center. It's the exercise of due care to refrain from any act which will cause foreseeable harm to others, even though you don't know who, you don't know what the harm is. Foreseeable harm. I would posit for the court that if foreseeability means anything in the duty formulation, then I think it's fair game in this case to evaluate whether a personal job undertaken by an employee borrowing the tools of Sylvan, borrowing the materials, could foreseeably result in a harm to somebody out in the world. Mr. Young has posited that there's no limit to that liability in terms of products that are produced.
Let's just go back a minute. When you state that, is there some overlap between the concept of duty and the concept of breach of a duty, that is, conduct that is not negligent, or conduct that is negligent? Negligent means what?
Negligent means that you have breached your duty to someone, duty of exercising ordinary care.
But don't you put foreseeability there?
I think you do.
Okay, that's my point. I think that when you look at these statements and pull them out of the cases, and you look at the foreseeability element in the statement of duty of care, the case then quickly moves to, was the conduct below the standard? And it's below the standard if it's foreseeable that there's a risk of harm.
Okay.
So I think when you look at the cases that way, you'll see that that's what the court does in its shift. Talks about duty of care, sometimes puts in foreseeability, sometimes doesn't. But when it gets to discuss breach, which is the negligence, right? That's where negligence comes in. That then it talks about foreseeability.
In the public policy application or limitation of...
Oh, sometimes just in what is negligent. Sometimes in public policy, because it may be foreseeable in terms of negligence, but that it's beyond the pale under public policy. So I think my reading of the cases, I see loose language in defining duty to moving into, to combining in the term duty of care, both duty of care and the violation thereof by negligence. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I think I do.
And what do you think about that?
Chief Justice, I, I think you asked Mr. Young what could be done to clarify the pronouncement of the
court. But do you agree that that's a potential problem in the language of the cases?
With all due respect to this court, yes, I do.
Okay.
I think that for an attorney like myself who spends the vast majority of his time defending corporations and persons in civil litigation, the idea of duty, the language is there repeatedly that foreseeability is part and parcel of the first step of the analysis on tort liability, duty. Duty is intertwined with foreseeability. However, all the way through your special statement in Nichols, making very clear that if there was any confusion out there that somehow this court is changing its view on the adherence through Pfeiffer of the minority view of Paul's graph, and that duty is duty to the universe for all intents and purposes, and that I think the court said foreseeability is really relegated, in effect, to the public policy limiting the application of liability. If that's the intention of this court, which is a perfectly admirable and appropriate intention, then I think you need to say it. I think we need to understand as practitioners and as potential litigants that foreseeability really is not a duty element. In practice, Your Honor, it strikes me that foreseeability is satisfied in the duty context whenever there's a harm. Is it reasonably foreseeable that somebody could get hurt? Well, when does that question come up? It comes up because somebody got hurt. And that up until the time that somebody got hurt, in this instance, because a non-pressure tank made on a government job was used by a third party under pressure, somebody 10 years down the road got hurt. Now, I look at that at the first line and say, why don't I look at this on foreseeability grounds on duty? If the court says duty is when there's a harm, it's thereby foreseeable, then let's move on to the limitation side of it. The application of duty in Wisconsin strikes me as being a manifestation of the Latin fallacy, post hoc ergo propter hoc. After this, therefore, because of this. So, Mr. Barrett got hurt because the tank that his boss got from the boss's father-in-law as a product of a personal job exploded 10 years later. Therefore, it has to be because he got it from Mr. Fisher through a personal job at Sylvan, and therefore Sylvan should have foreseen in some way, shape, or form that that should apply.
Mr. Laffey, if I might, let's return to the question that I asked you that I never really got an answer to. I asked you which approach you felt was the one you favored here. Now, you started out talking about duty, and then we drifted on to matters of breach and foreseeability. I think there are three choices here. One is breach, one is duty, and one is public policy. And I'm interested in, do you favor one of those three, or would you be happy with all three of them?
Well, I would be satisfied if all three were applied consistently. And the reason, Your Honor, that I got into the duty part of it is because I said I could live with all of them, let me talk about duty. And that, of course, brings us around to the academic but very important discussion of philosophically where we sit with duty. Breach would also be, in this particular case, the lack of breach, because what was produced as per the program at Sylvan, as a matter of fact, is exactly what was okay. Non-pressurized tank. Don't make tanks that we make. And that's exactly what happened. A tank that they don't make was made not to be pressurized. The case kind of falls off the rails here as a matter of fault and causation due to actions that happen clearly outside the employment relationship with Sylvan. In other words, it happens between Mr. Linchensky and Mr. Fisher. Either Mr. Fisher was told by Mr. Linchensky on the front end, I want a pressure tank, and Mr. Fisher mistakenly thought, as a veteran of the company, that making a non-pressurized vessel would be okay to be pressurized, or Mr. Fisher simply intentionally decided not to tell Mr. summers, we need to make a pressure vessel because my son-in-law wants to put pressure on this tank. Whatever that scenario, it has nothing to do with what went on in terms of anything involving Sylvan. So where's the breach in terms of Mr. Young wants to criticize the entire policy as being an act of negligence? There's no breach, even if it was a negligent policy. And then on foreseeability in the public policy realm, I think that's where you look at the work of the trial court and the Court of Appeals here. And the Court of Appeals, this is an unpublished opinion. And while perhaps, seeing that we're here today, I would have loved the Court of Appeals to give us an exposition on its full analysis of the public policy limitations rather than the one paragraph in the footnote or at the end of the opinion saying we don't need to address public policy, but the same analysis applies. I would like to have that for the record, but the same thought process, which in practice at this court, in the opinions from this court, what the Court of Appeals did was exactly the right analysis when evaluating how far is too far. How far should public policy allow potential liability to go? And the court in closing said, I've decided the case on duty, but it would be the same result for the same analysis under public policy. So I can accept, Justice Crooks, all three methodologies if the court were to so do that. My point on discussing duty is, to go to Chief Justice Abrahamson's point, if you felt the need to clarify the role of duty and foreseeability, then do it.
Well, do you think there's a need, and how would you do it?
If foreseeability is not intended to be a factor on the initial analysis of duty, then this court needs to simply say that. Simply, clearly, and unequivocally say, foreseeability is not part of the duty analysis because foreseeability is satisfied by the event of the harm.
So what you're saying is every time there's a harm, then retrospectively there's a duty.
I'm saying that by application of the opinions of this court, that's the effect. Okay. I don't agree that that's the analysis. I don't agree that the minority opinion in Paul's graph means that as long as something harmful happens to someone, then there is a duty. I don't agree with that. I don't agree that foreseeability is satisfied by the fact of an occurrence.
Do you agree with this? And this is out of AE Investment, and that is one of the, I don't want to say quintessential, that's too strong a term, but that's one of the key, yes, cases in the explanation of Wisconsin's approach. It was written in the early 70s by Heffernan, and he talks about FIFR, you know, 1952, and then CLASA coming along, and then he talks about the stocking case, Schilling case. And anyway, I'm reading from 485, and this just seems to be his capsule of the discussion of the minority view. And page 485, he says, as held in Schilling, once it is determined that a negligent act has been committed, and negligent is the breach. Are you following me? I just want to.
Okay, yeah.
And negligence is the breach because, of course, everyone, there is duty, but there's a duty to exercise ordinary care under the circumstances to everyone. So breach is the action, otherwise called negligence here. As held in Schilling, once it is determined that a negligent act has been committed and that the act is a substantial factor in causing the harm, the question of duty is irrelevant and a finding of non-liability can be made only in terms of public policy. Now that's his exegesis of the law through 1973, starting in 52. And we've repeated at least that part of the mantra, speaking of mantras, that Wisconsin adopts the minority view. And this is the description of the minority view, at least in part. Does this give you any insight to Wisconsin law as it existed in 1973?
Well, at first blush, it gives me a headache because it seems to be an octopus-like sentence where he noted, once it is determined that a negligent act has been committed, okay, parse that out. What's a negligent act? Duty and breach. Okay, once you've established that there's a breach of duty.
Yeah, that's right, because there's the focus isn't, as I read him here, the focus isn't on duty because of Paul's Grab Minority. We all owe a duty. So the focus is on the breach, the negligence. And once that is, and then you have causation.
Then cause. Right. So then you've got breach of the duty. Then you have cause established.
Duty? Don't shortcut that. The breach is a duty of due care.
Correct.
Under the circumstances.
That's
right. Exactly right.
Right.
Under the circumstances.
Which I would posit includes foreseeability on some level.
Right. Which we discussed, and you agreed then that breach includes foreseeability.
Agreed.
Okay. He agreed duty, I thought.
Includes foreseeability. The act or omission on the part of the putative tortfeasor would then be breach.
And that would be foreseeability too. You wouldn't be breach. You wouldn't be under the standard of care if you wasn't foreseeable.
Correct. Which I think is in the duty element, but
that's the discussion. That's the discussion, really. Where does foreseeability belong? And the arguments are foreseeability in the Paul's Graf minority position is in the
policy.
Well, no, but it's also in the breach. It's in public policy. Clearly it's in public policy because that deals with remoteness and et cetera, you know, which are inherent with regard to foreseeability and some of the other terms. But the question is, where does foreseeability belong? Does it belong with the concept of duty, or does it belong with the concept of breach? In Wisconsin, we collapse breach and duty and call it negligence. We do that, my understanding is, we do that because we adopt the minority, and so there's always a duty, you know, save special relationships. There's a duty, but the focus is on whether, as he says in A Investment, whether or not negligent act has been committed. So, I mean, you may come down in different ways, but I think that's the debate. Is it the focus on breach or focus on duty in Wisconsin's negligence?
I think it ought to be duty.
Well, I think that's different. I think that's different than, look at this laundry list. Well, I hate to say laundry list, but that makes it sound too domestic. But, cases like Hattelburg, 2005, Smaxwell, here's a 2004 case. Wisconsin has rejected the no-duty approach of the majority opinion in Paul's Graf. Fandry, 2004, however, Wisconsin has since followed the minority rationale in Paul's Graf, which posits that everyone owes a duty to the care to the entire world. Stephenson, Wilcox, adopting Paul's Graf, rejecting the no-duty approach. Pritzner, 2000. Saying Wisconsin does not follow the majority. We reject the majority's no-duty formula in Paul's Graf. Yonke, 2000. The court has long recognized everyone owes a duty at large. Morton, 2000. I mean, are we overruling these? Antoine, 1991. Rejecting no-duty, adopting Paul's Graf minority. Rockwhite, 1995. CC, 1988. And Schuster. Bowen, 1990. I mean, all of them say that.
They all say that, and they all call for an application of foreseeability in the duty analysis, and it's a case-by-case situation that you evaluate whether or not the potential harm is foreseeable under the law.
Can you have both? It seems to me there's a tension. How can you say that we owe a duty to everyone and then say, but...
My red light's on.
That's my answer.
Your Honor,
I stopped too.
That is the conundrum. That is the tension that is coming out of the opinions of this court on foreseeability's role in duty. We know foreseeability is an integral part of the public policy discussion in tort law. We know that. That's really not a question. The question,
and we know that it's part of due care.
It's, yes.
So we've got it in three places, according to you.
And, well, it's part of due care because you can't be expected to exercise due care unless there's some foreseeable harm that you must avoid causing.
Sure.
And so the foreseeability plays in a part there. That's correct.
Plays into what is negligence. That is the breach of the duty.
It has a role. I think it's less of a role. Once you establish the duty, you look at the result and you decide whether there's a causal connection, which in this case, I think cause in fact and proximate cause, not there at all, with intervening actions on the part of Mr. Linchensky and the lack of foreseeability of how this would be misused out in the field.
Justice Prosser.
Suppose the court were to say, henceforward, foreseeability has no role in duty. What's the downside to that?
The downside to that, I think there would be two pretty clear ones. Number one, as a matter of judicial management, there would be a dramatic uptick in the number of cases filed because there'd be no front-end limitation on tort liability. Number two, I think you then, without a foreseeability component to evaluating duty, you're then talking to folks, I represent corporations a lot, and I don't mean to focus on that, but potential defendants, how do you define what it is you're supposed to be guiding your conduct by if an element of foreseeability is not a germane part of the analysis on what duty citizens of Wisconsin owe? I think that is that'd be a dramatic shift, although maybe not in practice, but certainly in pronouncement. And where's the guidance? How do you prepare? How do you avoid a risk if it doesn't matter if you can foresee it or not? And if it truly is an unforeseeable risk, where it becomes a risk by fruition only because it happens, the post hoc ergo propter hoc conundrum, then how do I behave? There's no limit. I face potential exposure even if literally I as a potential defendant could have no reason to foresee that some act, loaning my neighbor a garden rake, and the neighbor winds up leaving that rake, tines up, and somebody steps on it. Under Mr. Young's theory, I'm subjected to liability. I am an acceptable defendant because it's foreseeable that something bad could happen if that rake, in my example, is misused by my neighbor.
Don't you have a whole lot of doctrines like independent force of the neighbors? You're not liable if there's an independent intervening act. I mean, that's a doctrine. And it comes in because of foreseeability in terms of what is negligence. The case can be filed, but as a matter of law, the court could find no negligence. The case can be filed even if duty has foreseeability. The case can always be filed. The question is, how to get rid of it in the court system, right?
Correct. And if foreseeability, in my example, is not going to be a factor, then I am more likely than not going to have to fight that fight through complete discovery, and maybe even trial, even though all I did was loan my neighbor a rake.
You took the factor out of duty, as Justice Prosser suggested, but he didn't suggest you take the factor out of negligence.
Correct.
So there's a factor there still of foreseeability and negligence. So no matter where you put foreseeability, the same rules ought to apply as to how that case is treated.
Unless this court believes that foreseeability is of a different kind and quality depending upon where along the chain of the analysis it falls. But yes, conceptually, Your Honor, I do agree with you.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Young?
So much to talk about, so little time. I thought the same thing when Mr. Laffey was up here, of how it hurts our heads when we try to
bring some sense, not that there isn't sense, but reconcile these intertwined questions of foreseeability. Is it foreseeable that Sylvan, who undertakes a program that allows its employees to use its facilities, its means, its equipment, its employees, could produce something that would be dangerous to a third person? In this situation, that clearly happened, and of course it's foreseeable. And I think that's part of the negligence analysis, mostly.
And that's sort of a tangential response to Mr. Laffey's observation that the company, the whole purpose of this program was employee morale. But, well, actually, that was your point. But that begs a question, it seems to me, which is, where really is the stopping point in terms of holding an employer vicariously liable when its benefit supposedly is employee morale, when really employee morale, it seems to me, plays a factor in just about every determination that a responsible employer makes?
I think when we talk about the stopping point in the vicarious liability issue, and I don't know if we're talking public policy now being applied to vicarious liability, but Mr. Laffey made a strong point about the intent. And it sounded to me like he was talking about the employee's subjective intent. And I doubt that Mr. Fisher, while he was benefiting himself, which is a benefit to the company, he happens to be benefiting himself under the program that is intended to benefit the employees, and so that the company is getting that benefit. Subjectively, I wouldn't figure that he'd be thinking subjectively, I'm benefiting my employer, any different than the in the Minaquabats, where the employee takes the shotgun and shoots it under the door as a prank on a co-employee. And that was found to be within the scope of employment. And in that case, the court, there can be no question in that situation that was a benefiting employee.
Wasn't it a significant factor in the Minaquabats case that the employee who fired the shotgun under the doorway where the other employee was changing, or the volunteer, I guess, was actually preparing to go on and put a display, or they do water ski shows. Wasn't that a significant factor in the court's decision there, that it actually was in the scope of his employment?
And I agree with you, Your Honor, and that's exactly my point.
That this was in the that this was in the scope of Mr. Fisher's employment, is that your point?
Yes, and here's why. In the Minaquabats, the court said, proof that the actor was in the general employment of the master does not of itself create an inference that the given act was in the scope of employment. If, however, it is also proved that the act tended to accomplish an authorized purpose, and we have that here.
The manufacture of a pressurized tank was an authorized purpose in direct competition to the employer?
We submit there are issues of fact about whether there actually was a policy prohibiting pressurized tanks or whether they really allowed, and that we have submitted in our briefs facts that show that this story.
Was Sylvan engaged on a routine and regular basis in the manufacture of pressurized tanks?
In fact, they did make pressure vessels.
And did they sell those on a regular basis?
If they were asked to, they would. Mr. Saar testified to that.
And so you're saying that it would actually be fulfilling Sylvan's purpose. It would be fulfilling the purpose of the employer to have an employee manufacture products which, in fact, the employer would actually have the opportunity to sell.
Yeah, I may not be following you around.
Fisher is making a product, apparently. Mr. Fisher was making a product, you are arguing, that would be in direct contradiction, direct competition with his employer's business. Isn't that what you're saying? Isn't that a part and parcel of your argument?
No, I think what I'm saying is that this program gave an authorized purpose, and that Mr. Sylvan and Mr. Fisher was similar to the clown actor in the Minaquabats, was engaged in an act which tended to accomplish an authorized purpose. He was getting ready to put on the show,
and that the act was done at an authorized place and time, then there's an inference that it's in the scope of employment, and both of those are present in our case. Mr. Fisher, when he's telling Rex Summers to do this, and they're spending this all on company time and getting paid while they're doing it and using, it was all authorized by Sylvan. There's no dispute about that. So in terms of scope of, if Mr. Laffey is correct, then Scott versus Minocqua is wrong. In Destel, the sheriff who was accused of falsely imprisoning the suspect, that case should not have gone to the jury because there can't be a policy allowing that kind of thing. Your Honors, Sylvan is not a bystander like the defendant in Rockwhite. Here, Sylvan produced the means for the fire. Sylvan is, this case is much stronger than Alvarado, where the inspection company just missed the firework. Here, Sylvan, in effect, provided the firework. They provided the means, like the guns in the other two cases. So their connection is much stronger than these other cases we've discussed.
Thank you, Mr. Young. Thank you, Mr. Laffey, for yet another discussion of the four elements of a liability case in negligence. That concludes our hearing on 06AP2910, Kenneth Barrand versus Gulf Underwriters Insurance Company. The court will take a few moments in recess, so counsel and the students may leave, and another group of students may enter the courtroom.